Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a man who is bored has got hold of a microphone and is going to use it to be wrong on the internet. Last episode, I was thinking about a rescue project I was working on where I had a PHP program that had been built by someone who was very much learning as they went, and so it's managed to build a lot of the functionality that they needed, but what was causing me problems was the lack of usability of their code. The sort of developer experience was very poor. It was hard to understand, hard to use outside of the production environment. Didn't really have any obvious design or patterns or anything. And through thinking about how I learned to program, and trying to empathize with this person who was probably in a similar situation to one I had been in a number of years back, and thinking about what it was that brought me from that position where I could program, but you wouldn't call what I was doing engineering, to a modern state where I'm able to understand why a lot of software engineering practices are used, why certain practices aren't used, and the benefits that these things bring. Made me think about my time as a child working with 1980s microcomputers, particularly the first computer I used, which belonged to my parents, was a Dragon 32, which for American listeners is very similar to the Tandy color computer. The two options you really had for programming on that thing were machine code, i.e. writing instructions directly for the processor. The Dragon 32 used the 6809 processor from Motorola. Similar systems would have used the MOSTEC 6502 or other 8-bit CPUs, the Zilog Z80, for example. And that was incredibly unusable, really. For most of us who were amateurs or inexperienced and trying to just get someone's program to work, all we had was a massive string of numbers that we had to type in exactly correctly, and then hope that it worked. It was very hard to get it right, and it was very hard to understand what you had got wrong. You really had to do a sort of byte-by-byte comparison of the program that you had entered and the program that you had wanted to enter, and check whether they were the same. On the other hand, for people who were experienced at this, there were some very powerful tools like monitors. In a way that you can't do with a modern computer, you really could just see the entire state of the computer. You could look at the registers, you could look at every byte in memory, and assuming you knew how to interpret it, if you had memory mapped I/O, then what devices were writing into the memory at particular locations, or what devices would get controlled if you wrote into those locations. It was easy to understand, or at least possible to understand, the entire behaviour of the computer. But most people who were learning to program, and even a lot of professional programmers, weren't using the machine language of the computer. They weren't using the instruction set of the processor. They were using the BASIC that was built in. And that had a lot of usability problems as well, although it wasn't necessarily the cause of mental mutilation, as Dijkstra claimed. In fact, the BASIC was the thing that gave me the revelation that a computer isn't some sort of magic box that does things that have been brought down from Olympus. It's a device that's entirely under my control, Or at least, you know, the commuters at the time were, without their digital restrictions management and so on. But they gave me the idea that there was a thing in there that could be controlled and that I could make it do the things that I wanted to. And without the basic, that would have been, you know, very hard to envision. And of course, we had some tools. We had a REPL, we had a read, evaluate, print loop. You can type basic commands directly into the computer and see their results. And an online debugger, wherever you were, you could hit the break key in your program and you would get back down to the REPL and you could see the current state of the program and modify both the state in memory and the current program listing and then start again. So we had a very, very sophisticated debugging and really interactive testing environment as well. So what was the thing that made BASIC so unusable, or made the developer experience so poor? You know, I recently came to the conclusion, or to the realization, that I've sort of had this idea in my mind that we didn't learn how to read code when we learned how to write code. You know, my experience learning programming was one of learning how to construct a program, not one of learning how to evaluate or critique a program, and that, you know, this is the cause of problems with writing code that's readable, working on teams of programmers, of code review techniques and so on. But actually, if I look at what I was doing, mostly I was reading magazines that had program listings in and explained what those programs did and how they achieved them. So I was really taught to program by interpreting literate programs and by using them myself. So my view that I didn't learn how to read code just doesn't hold up to scrutiny. But I don't feel like the reading of code that I did, you know, as a child learning to program with BASIC on a micro necessarily translated to being able to read, interpret and critique code now. So there must have been some shortfall some way in which this was presented that meant that I didn't learn the lessons that were clearly directly in front of me. I think there were real constraints, obviously. These computers didn't have much memory, so sometimes you would turn off the graphics of the computer so that you could use the memory mapped graphics page for scratch space for your program. Sometimes you would see tricks, like particularly on the ZX BASIC that was in computers like the ZX 80 and 81, where rather than use the literal number 1, which takes up 5 bytes in the computer's memory, you would see the variable O, which needs 1 byte, defined as the value pi divided by pi. And then you've got the pi keyword takes up 1 byte. You've got the divide by symbol takes up 1 byte. And you've got the assignment and the variable name and variable space, which is 5 bytes. So you've got one for the name of the variable, one for the equal sign, one for the keyword pi, one for divided by, and one for pi. So that's 5 bytes, and then you're storing the result in another 5, that's 10. But now every time you use the number 1, you're not using the 5 bytes of the literal number 1, you're using the 1 byte of the reference into the variable table of the letter O. So you get an incremental use of only 1 byte every time you use number 1, and you would see similar things like 0 would be defined as pi minus pi, or 2 would be O plus O, and so on. And yeah, these were real sort of tricks that you had to learn, that if you didn't know what they were or why the person was doing them, would be, you know, confusing to read, but had genuine effects. The ZX80 in particular had a very, very small memory, and so it made a lot of sense to shrink the size of your program. It also meant that you didn't see a lot of comments. You would often see like a sort of boilerplate at the start. Comments were rem statements. Again, you know, we need one byte for the rem keyword, and then everything else is one byte per character, and that's just stored in a program listing and doesn't get executed. But we see very little explanation of what the program does inside the program for two reasons. One was that the explanation would be outside it. If it was something that was published in a magazine, it would be in the article. If it was something that the program was making for their own use, then they would have their own documentation, like maybe a flowchart diagram or a pseudocode description on a sheet of paper somewhere that explained how the code works. And so comments weren't weren't being written. Again, saving space. But sometimes the constraints were due to the implementation of the BASIC in the computer's ROM. So some BASICs only let you have a one-letter variable name or a one-letter function name. And so you would try and define your program firstly so it only needed 26 variables, which might mean reusing some variables. So you couldn't even have a table that says S is the speed of the player's character, because S might be the score in some other part in the code. It also meant that there wasn't necessarily a mapping. If you've already used S for speed, then you might end up using C for score, because you can't like reuse S and you can't type out the full words. But sometimes we used those constraints. We over-applied them, you know, due to some like folklore or convention. Because don't forget, over time, over the period of the sort of 8-bit microcomputer, the amount of memory actually increased quite a lot. The ZX80 may have had 1 kilobyte of memory, but the last of the ZX Spectrum line had 128K. The Sinclair QL, which was the Motorola 68008 CPU, could address even more memory than that. And we carried on with these sort of conventions and tricks that we'd learned to compress the memory use. But these computers only ran one program at a time. So actually all of that 32, 48, 64, 128 kilobytes of RAM was all being used for our program. So we could have easily put some better user interface, some more comments, some better documentation, some like more expanded and less space efficient algorithms into our programs. We could have done that because we didn't need to, once we got past the ceiling of the memory use, you know, once we were below the total amount of RAM on the computer, we didn't really need to shrink our program anymore. And of course, the sort of design technique where you would plan out your software on paper, maybe like draw a flowchart, led to particular design choices being made at implementation time. If you've got a flowchart and you can see the linear path through the software and the decisions that are made throughout the algorithm, then it's quite natural to use the go-to statement to say, I need to go from this part of the program, this box on the flowchart, to that part of the program, that box, rather than decomposing into subroutines or into functions, because you've planned out the whole program in advance, so you don't need to think about building it up from smaller components. And there wasn't really the concept of reusability. Your entire program is going to be streamed probably to a cassette, although maybe to a disk, or printed out in a listing, and is going to be entered as an atomic unit, as a sort of monadic program. It's not going to be broken out. You're not going to be sharing a library of useful numerical algorithms or like game design routines or anything. You're just going to be giving out the entire program. So there's less impetus to design reusable functions or subroutines. So many of the tricks that we use to compress memory space. As I said, once we've got past like the high water mark that you can't use more memory than the computer has, everything else is really code golf. You're just making the thing smaller because it's possible to make it smaller. Now, in the demo scene, that was where all of the like impressive skill and the cleverness was. Like, the smaller you make your program, the more you can make the computer do, and the more you weirdly use side effects of the way that the computer does, say, graphics or sound, or make use of bugs in the ROM to get desirable behavior, the better your demo is going to be. But in the general area of helping people to use their computers to do their budget or something, those tricks were really out of place. So I think my conclusion is that we have improved the amount in which our code is readable, and we have improved the practices that we use to make readable code, and that this isn't wholly due to being less constrained, having more memory on our systems, having the ability to write longer comments, or attach pictures to our source code repositories or whatever. It's partly through changes in culture. Programmers would often be writing alone when they were working on microcomputer software, even doing all of the graphics and sound themselves. It wasn't uncommon for a game developed for a computer like the Tandy Coco or the Commodore 64 to be developed by one person, and then the people at the distributors would draw the box artwork, but everything that went into the computer was done by one person. We typically work on larger teams now, and of course we have the understanding that it's a valuable thing to work with collaborators from the problem domains. We've scaled up our ambition, and so we need to understand more about the problems we're trying to solve. So we have to work with more people. And so we've developed a collection of principles and of practices, of ways of working, that lend themselves to code being more readable. So I was incorrect to think that I hadn't learned how to read code. I had learned how to read code despite the intentions of the authors, not because of the intentions of the authors. And that's the big change that we've seen in the last few decades. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. A couple of people mentioned on the last episode that there was a lot of background noise. That, it turns out, was due to plugging my microphone into the wrong USB socket. Hopefully that's fixed now. I'd love to hear about that. I've had a request to do an episode in the future on design by contract and on my Java by contracts project, so I will do that. Thank you very much for that feedback. Any feedback you have on this episode, anything you'd like to hear about in the future, please just send me an email, graham@iamlege.com, that's graham@iamlege.com, or tweet iwaslege at IWASLEEG on Twitter. Thanks very much for listening. Stay safe. See you next time.